disturbing her indenture with Councilman Hood's household. He thought because she was a healer and not a heartrender, he was making the safe choice to test the Param.
Seemed smart enough. Kaz had seen heartrenders at work. They could rupture your cells, burst your heart in your chest, steal the breath from your lungs, or lower your pulse so that you dropped into a coma, all while never laying a finger on you. If even part of what Van Eck said was true, the idea of one of them dosed with Jordaparam was a daunting proposition. So the Merchers had tried the drug on a healer instead. But apparently things hadn't gone according to plan.
You gave her the drug, and she killed her master.
Not exactly, Van Eck said, clearing his throat.
They had her in that observation cell. Within seconds of consuming the Param, she took control of the guard inside the chamber.
How?
We don't know exactly. But whatever method she used, it allowed her to subdue these guards as well.
That's not possible.
Isn't it? The brain is just one more organ, a cluster of cells and impulses. Why shouldn't a Grisha under the influence of Jordaparam be able to manipulate those impulses?
Kaz's disbelief must have shown. Look at these people, Van Eck insisted. She told them to wait. And that's exactly what they've done. That's all they've done since.
Kaz studied the silent group more closely. Their eyes weren't blank or dead. Their bodies weren't quite at rest. They were expectant. He suppressed a shiver. He'd seen peculiar things, extraordinary things, but nothing like what he'd witnessed tonight.
What happened to Hode?
She commanded him to open the door, and when he did, she ordered him to cut the thumb from his hand. We only know how it all happened because a kitchen boy was present. The Grisha girl left him untouched, but he claims Hode carved away his own thumb, smiling all the while. Kaz didn't like the idea of some Grisha moving things around in his head. But he wouldn't be surprised if Hode deserved whatever he'd gotten. During Ravka's civil war, a lot of Grisha had fled the fighting and paid their way to Kerch by becoming indentures without realizing that they'd essentially sold themselves into slavery.
The Merch is dead.
Councilman Hode lost a great deal of blood, but he's in the same state as these men. He's been removed to the country with his family and the staff from his house.
Did the Grisha healer go back to Ravka? Kaz asked. Van Eck gestured Kaz out of the eerie boathouse and locked the door behind them.
She may have attempted it, he said as they retraced their steps through the garden and along the side of the house. We know she secured a small craft, and we suspect she was headed to Ravka. But we found her body washed up 2 days ago near Third Harbor. We think she drowned trying to get back into the city.
Why would she come back here?
For more Jordaparam. Kaz thought of Mika's glittering eyes and waxy skin.
Is that addictive?
It seems to take only one dose. Once the drug has run its course, it leaves the Grisha's body weakened, and the craving is intense.
It's quite debilitating.
Quite debilitating seemed like a bit of an understatement. The Council of Tides controlled entry to the Ketterdam harbors. If the drugged healer had tried to return at night in a small boat, she wouldn't have had much of a chance against the current.
Kaz thought of Mika's gaunt face. The way his clothes hung from his body. The drug had done that to him. He'd been high on Jordaparam and already greedy for the next dose. He'd also looked ready to keel over. How long could Grisha go on that way? It was an interesting question, but not relevant to the matter at hand. They'd arrived at the front gate. It was time to saddle up.
30 million Kruger. Kaz said.
We said 20, sputtered Van Eck.
You said 20.
It's clear you're desperate. Kaz glanced back in the direction of the boathouse where a room full of men simply waited to die. And now I see why.
Council will have my head.
They'll sing your praises once you have Bo Yul-Bayor safely hidden away wherever you intend to keep him.
Novia Zem. Kaz shrugged.
You can put him in a coffee pot for all I care.
Van Eck's gaze locked on his. You've seen what this drug can do. I assure you it's just the beginning. If Jorda Perem is unleashed on the world, war is inevitable. Our trade lines will be destroyed and our markets will collapse. Kirch will not survive it. Our hopes rest with you, Mr. Brecker. If you fail, all the world will suffer for it.
Oh, it's worse than that, Van Eck. If I fail, I don't get paid.
The look of disgust on the merchant's face was something that deserved its own decoppel oil to commemorate it.
Don't look so disappointed. Just think how miserable you would have been to discover this canal rat had a patriotic streak. You might actually have had to uncurl that lip and treat me with something closer to respect.
Thank you for sparing me that discomfort, Van Eck said disdainfully. He opened the door, then paused. I do wonder what a boy of your intelligence might have amounted to under different circumstances. Ask Jordy, Kaz thought, with a bitter pang. But he simply shrugged.
I'd just be stealing from a better class of sucker. 30 million Kruga.
Van Eck nodded.
30. The deal is the deal. The deal is the deal, Kaz said. They shook.
As Van Eck's neatly manicured hand clasped Kaz's leather-clad fingers, the merch narrowed his eyes.
Why do you wear the gloves, Mr. Brecker?
Kaz raised a brow.
I'm sure you've heard the stories.
Each more grotesque than the last.
Kaz had heard them too. Brecker's hands were stained with blood. Brecker's hands were covered in scars. Brecker had claws and not fingers because he was part demon. Brecker's touch burned like brimstone. A single brush of his bare skin caused your flesh to wither and die.
Pick one, Kaz said as he vanished into the night.
Thoughts already turning to 30 million Kruga. And the crew he'd need to help him get it.
They're all true enough.
4. Inej. Inej knew the moment Kaz entered the slat. His presence reverberated through the cramped rooms and crooked hallways as every thug, thief, dealer, con man, and steerer came a little more awake. Per Haskell's favored lieutenant was home. The slat wasn't much, just another house in the worst part of the barrel. 3 stories, stacked tight on top of each other, crowned with an attic and a gabled roof. Most of the buildings in this part of the city had been built without foundations, many on swampy land where the canals were haphazardly dug. They leaned against each other like tipsy friends gathering at a bar, tilting at drowsy angles. Inej had visited plenty of them on errands for the dregs. And they weren't much better on the inside. Cold and damp, plaster sliding from the walls. Gaps in the windows wide enough to let in the rain and snow. But Kaz had spent his own money to have the slat's drafts shorn up and its walls insulated. It was ugly, crooked and crowded. But the slat was gloriously dry. Inej's room was on the 3rd floor, a skinny slice of space barely big enough for a cot and a trunk, but with a window that looked out over the peaked roofs and jumbled chimneys of the barrel. When the wind came through and cleared away the haze of coal smoke that hung over the city, she could even make out a blue pocket of harbor. Though dawn was just a few hours away, the slat was wide awake. The only time the house was ever really quiet was in the slow hours of the afternoon, and tonight everyone was buzzing with the news of the showdown at the exchange, Big Bolliger's fate, and now poor Rojak's dismissal. Inej had gone straight from her conversation with Kaz to seek out the card dealer at the Crow Club. He'd been at the tables dealing three men bramble for Jesper and a couple of Ravkin tourists. When he'd finished the hand, Inej had suggested they speak in one of the private gaming parlors to spare him the embarrassment of being fired in front of his friends. But Rojak wasn't having it. "It's not fair," he bellowed when she told him Kaz's orders. "I ain't no cheat." "Take it up with Kaz," Inej had replied quietly. "And keep your voice down," Jesper added, glancing at the tourists and sailors seated at the neighboring tables. Fights were common in the barrel, but not on the floor of the Crow Club. If you had a gripe, you settled it outside, where you didn't risk interrupting the hallowed practice of separating pigeons from their money. "Where's Brecker?" growled Rojak. "I don't know." "You always know everything about everything," Rojak sneered, leaning in the stink of lager and onions on his breath. "Isn't that what Dirty Hands pays you for?" "I don't know where he is or when he's getting back, but I do know. You won't want to be here when he does." "Give me my check. I'm owed for my last shift." "Brecker doesn't owe you anything. He can't even face me. Sends a little girl to give me the boot. Maybe I'll just shake a few coins out of you." He'd reached out to grab her by the collar of her shirt, but she'd dodged him easily. He fumbled for her again. Out of the corner of her eye, Inej saw Jesper rise from his seat, but she waved him off and slipped her fingers into the brass knuckles she kept in her right hip pocket. She gave Rojak a swift crack across the left cheek. His hand flew up to his face. "Hey," he said, "I didn't hurt you none. It was just words." People were watching now, so she hit him again. Regardless of the Crow Club rules, this took precedence. When Kaz had brought her to the slat, he'd warned her that he wouldn't be able to watch out for her, that she'd have to fend for herself, and she had. It would have been easy enough to turn away when they called her names or sidled up to ask for a cuddle, but do that, and soon it was a hand up your blouse or a try at you against a wall. So she'd let no insult or innuendo slide. She'd always struck first and struck hard. Sometimes she even cut them up a bit. It was fatiguing, but nothing was sacred to the Kirch except trade, so she'd gone out of her way to make the risk much higher than the reward when it came to disrespecting her. Rojak touched his fingers to the ugly bruise forming on his cheek, looking surprised and a bit betrayed.
"I thought we was friendly," he protested.
The sad part was that they were. Inej liked Rojak, but right now he was just a frightened man looking to feel bigger than someone.
"Rojak," she'd said, "I've seen you work a deck of cards. You can get a job in almost any den. Go home, and be grateful Kaz doesn't take what you owe him out of your hide, hmm?"
He'd gone, a bit wobbly on his feet, still clutching his cheek like a stunned toddler. And Jesper had sauntered over.
"He's right, you know. Kaz shouldn't send you to do his dirty work.
It's all dirty work.
But we do it just the same," he said with a sigh.
"You look exhausted. Will you sleep at all tonight?"
Jesper just winked.
"Not while the cards are hot. Stay and play a bit. Kaz will stake you."
"Really, Jesper?" she had said, pulling up her hood. "If I want to watch men dig holes to fall into, I'll find myself a cemetery."
"Come on, Inej,"
he'd called after her as she passed through the big double doors onto the street.
"Your good luck!"
Saints, she thought. If he believes that, he really must be desperate.
She'd left her luck behind in a Suli camp on the shores of West Ravka. She doubted she'd see either again. Now Inej left her tiny chamber in the slat and headed downstairs by way of the banisters. There was no reason to cloak her movements here, but silence was habit, and the stairs tended to squeak like mating mice. When she reached the second floor landing and saw the crowd milling below, she hung back. Kaz had been gone longer than anyone had expected, and as soon as he'd entered the shadowy foyer, he'd been waylaid by people looking to congratulate him on his routing of Giles and asking for news of the Black Tips.
Rumor has it Giles is already putting together a mob to move on us, said Annika.
Let him, rumbled Dirix. I've got an axe handle with his name on it.
Giles won't act for a while, said Kaz as he moved down the hall. He doesn't have the numbers to face us in the streets, and his coffers are too empty to hire on more hands. Shouldn't you be on your way to the Crow Club?
The raised eyebrow was enough to send Annika scurrying away, Dirix on her heels. Others came to offer congratulations or make threats against the Black Ships. No one went so far as to pat Kaz on the back, though. That was a good way to lose a hand. Inej knew Kaz would stop to speak to Per Haskell. So instead of descending the final flight of stairs, she moved down the hallway. There was a closet here full of odds and ends, old chairs with broken backs, paint-splattered canvas sheeting. Inej moved aside a bucket full of cleaning supplies that she'd placed there precisely because she knew no one in the slat would ever touch it. The grate beneath it offered a perfect view of Per Haskell's office. She felt slightly guilty for eavesdropping on Kaz, but he was the one who had turned her into a spy. You couldn't train a falcon, then expect it not to hunt. Through the grate, she heard Kaz's knock on Per Haskell's door, and the sound of his greeting.
Back and still breathing, the old man inquired.
She could just see him seated in his favorite chair, fiddling with a model ship he'd been building for the better part of a year.
A pint of lager within arm's reach, as always.
We won't have a problem with the Fifth Harbor again.
Haskell grunted and returned to his model ship.
Close the door.
Inej heard it shut, muffling the sounds from the hallway. She could see the top of Kaz's head. His dark hair was damp. It must have started raining.
You should have gotten permission for me to deal with Bolliger, said Haskell. If I had talked to you first, word might have gotten out. You think I'd let that happen?
Kaz's shoulders lifted.
This place is like anything in Ketterdam. It leaks.
Inej could have sworn he looked directly at the vent when he said it.
I don't like it, boy. Big Bolliger was my soldier, not yours.
Of course, Kaz said. But they both knew it was a lie. Haskell's dregs were old guard, con men and crooks from another time. Bolliger had been one of Kaz's crew, new blood, young and unafraid. Maybe too unafraid.
You're smart, Brecker, but you need to learn patience. Yes, sir.
The old man barked a laugh.
Yes, sir. No, sir, he mocked. I know you're up to something when you start getting polite. Just what have you got brewing? A job, Kaz said. I may need to be gone for a spell. Big money? Very. Big risk? That too. But you'll get your 20%. You don't make any major moves without my say-so. Understood?
Kaz must have nodded because Per Haskell leaned back in his chair and took a sip of lager.
Are we going to be very rich? Rich as saints and crowns of gold.
The old man snorted.
Long as I'll have to live like one. I'll talk to Pym, Kaz said. He can pick up the slack while I'm gone.
Inej frowned. Just where was Kaz going? He hadn't mentioned any big job to her, and why Pym? The thought shamed her a bit. She could almost hear her father's voice.
So eager to be the queen of thieves, Inej.
It was one thing to do her job and do it well. It was quite another to want to succeed at it. She didn't want a permanent place with the dregs. She wanted to pay off her debts and be free of Ketterdam forever. So why should she care if Kaz chose Pym to run the gang in his absence?
Because I'm smarter than Pym.
Because Kaz trusts me more. But maybe he didn't trust the crew to follow a girl like her, only 2 years out of the brothels, not even 17 years old. She wore her sleeves long, and the sheath of her knife mostly hid the scar on the inside of her left forearm, where the menagerie tattoo had once been. But they all knew it was there. Kaz exited Haskell's room, and Inej left her perch to wait for him as he limped his way up the stairs.
Rojak,
he asked as he passed her and started up the second flight. Gone, she said, falling in behind him.
He put up much of a fight?
Nothing I couldn't handle.
Not what I asked.
He was angry. He may come back around looking for trouble.
Never a shortage of that to hand out,
Kaz said as they reached the top floor. The attic rooms had been converted into his office and bedroom. She knew all those flights of stairs were brutal on his bad leg, but he seemed to like having the whole floor to himself. He entered the office and, without looking back at her, said,
Shut the door.
The room was mostly taken up by a makeshift desk, an old warehouse door atop stacked fruit crates, piled high with papers. Some of the floor bosses had started using adding machines, clanking things crowded with stiff brass buttons and spools of paper. But Kaz did the Crow Club tallies in his head. He kept books, but only for the sake of the old man, and so that he had something to point to when he called someone out for cheating or when he was looking for new investors. That was one of the big changes Kaz had brought to the gang. He'd given ordinary shopkeepers and legitimate businessmen the chance to buy shares in the Crow Club. At first, they'd been skeptical. Sure, it was some kind of swindle, but he'd brought them in with tiny stakes and managed to gather enough capital to purchase the dilapidated old building, spruce it up, and get it running. It had paid back for those early investors, or so the story went. Inej could never be sure which stories about Kaz were true and which were rumors he'd planted to serve his own ends. For all she knew, he'd conned some poor, honest trader out of his life savings to make the Crow Club thrive.
I've got a job for you,
Kaz said as he flipped through the previous day's figures. Each sheet would go into his memory with barely a glance.
What would you say to 4 million krug?
Money like that is more curse than gift.
My little Suli idealist, all you need is a full belly and an open road,
he said, the mockery clear in his voice.
And an easy heart, Kaz.
That was the difficult part. Now he laughed outright as he walked through the door to his tiny bedroom.
No hopes of that. I'd rather have the cash. Do you want the money or not?
You're not in the business of giving gifts. What's the job?
An impossible job. Near certain death, terrible odds, but should we scrape it?
He paused, fingers on the buttons of his waistcoat, his look distant, almost dreamy. It was rare that she heard such excitement in his raspy voice. Should we scrape it? She prompted. He grinned at her, his smile sudden and jarring as a thunderclap, his eyes the near black of bitter coffee.
There'll be kings and queens, Inej. Kings and queens.
She said noncommittally, pretending to examine one of her knives, determined to ignore that grin. Kaz was not a giddy boy smiling and making future plans with her. He was a dangerous player who was always working an angle. Always, she reminded herself firmly. Inej kept her eyes averted, shuffling a stack of papers into a pile on the desk as Kaz stripped out of his vest and shirt. She wasn't sure if she was flattered or insulted that he didn't seem to give a second thought to her presence. How long will we be gone? She asked, darting a glance at him through the open doorway. He was corded muscle, scars, but only two tattoos. The dregs Crow and Cup on his forearm, and above it a black R on his bicep. She'd never asked him what it meant. It was his hands that drew her attention as he shucked off his leather gloves and dipped a cloth in the wash basin. He only ever removed them in these chambers, and as far as she knew, only in front of her. Whatever affliction he might be hiding, she could see no sign of it. Only slender lockpick's fingers, and a shiny rope of scar tissue from some long-ago street fight.
A few weeks, maybe a month,
he said as he ran the wet cloth under his arms and the hard planes of his chest, water trickling down his torso. For saint's sake, Inej thought as her cheeks heated. She'd lost most of her modesty during her time with the menagerie, but Really, there were limits. What would Kaz say if she suddenly stripped down and started washing herself in front of him? He'd probably tell me not to drip on the desk, she thought with a scowl. A month, she said. Are you sure you should be leaving with the black tips so riled up?
This is the right gamble. Speaking of which, round up Jesper and Muzzin. I want them here by dawn. And I'll need Wylan waiting at the Crow Club tomorrow night.
Wylan?
If this is for a big job,
just do it.
Inej crossed her arms. One minute he made her blush, and the next he made her want to commit murder. Are you going to explain any of this?
When we all meet.
He shrugged on a fresh shirt, then hesitated as he fastened the collar.
This isn't an assignment, Inej. It's a job for you to take or leave as you see fit.
An alarm bell rang inside her. She endangered herself every day on the streets of the Barrel. She'd murdered for the dregs, stolen, brought down bad men and good, and Kaz had never hinted that any of the assignments were less than a command to be obeyed. This was the price she'd agreed to when Per Haskell had purchased her contract and liberated her from the menagerie. So what was different about this job? Kaz finished with his buttons, pulled on a charcoal waistcoat, and tossed her something. It flashed in the air and she caught it with one hand. When she opened her fist, she saw a massive ruby tie pin circled by golden laurel leaves.
Fence it, Kaz said.
Whose is it?
Ours now.
Whose was it? Kaz stayed quiet. He picked up his coat, using a brush to clean the dried mud from it.
Someone who should have thought better before he had me jumped.
Jumped?
You heard me.
Someone got the drop on you. He looked at her and nodded once. Unease snaked through her and twisted into an anxious, rusting coil. No one got the better of Kaz. He was the toughest, scariest thing walking the alleys of the Barrel. She relied on it. So did he.
It won't happen again, he promised.
Kaz pulled on a clean pair of gloves, snapped up his walking stick, and headed out the door.
I'll be back in a few hours. Move the decoupel we lifted from Van Eck's house to the vault. I think it's rolled up under my bed. Oh, and put in an order for a new hat. Please.
Kaz heaved a sigh as he braced himself for three painful flights of stairs. He looked over his shoulder and said,
Please. My darling, Inej, treasurer of my heart, won't you do me the honor of acquiring me a new hat?
Inej cast a meaningful glance at his cane.
Have a long trip down, she said,
then leapt onto the banister, sliding from one flight to the next, slick as butter in a pan.
5. Kaz. Kaz followed East Stave toward the harbor, through the beginnings of the Barrel's gambling district. The infamous tangle of narrow streets and minor waterways known as the Barrel was bracketed by two major canals, East Stave and West Stave, each catering to a particular clientele. The buildings of the Barrel were different from anywhere else in Ketterdam, bigger, wider, painted in every garish color, clamoring for attention from passers-by. The treasure chest, the Golden Bend, Weddell's riverboat, the best of the betting halls were located farther north, in the prime real estate of the Lid, the section of the canal closest to the harbors, favorably situated to attract tourists and sailors coming into port. But not the Crow Club. Kaz mused as he looked up at the black and crimson facade. It had taken a lot to lure tourists and risk hungry merchants this far south for entertainment. Now the hour was coming up on 4 bells. And the crowds were still thick outside the club. Kaz watched the tide of people flowing past the portico's black columns, beneath the watchful eye of the oxidized silver crow that spread its wings above the entrance. Bless the pigeons, he thought.
Bless all you kind and generous folk, ready to empty your wallets into the dregs' coffers and call it a good time. He could see barkers out front shouting to potential customers, offering free drinks, hot pots of coffee, and the fairest deals in all of Ketterdom. He acknowledged them with a nod and pressed farther north. Only one other gambling den on the stave mattered to him. The Emerald Palace, Pekka Rollins' pride and joy. The building was an ugly green, decked out in artificial trees laden with fake gold and silver coins. The whole place had been done up as some kind of tribute to Rollins' Kalish heritage and his gang, the Dime Lions. Even the girls working the chip counters and tables wore glittering green sheaths of silk and had their hair tinted a dark, unnatural red to mimic the look of girls from the Wandering Isle. As Kaz passed the emerald, he looked up at the false gold coins, letting the anger come at him. He needed it tonight as a reminder of what he'd lost, of what he stood to gain. He needed it to prepare him for this reckless endeavor. Brick by brick, he muttered to himself. They were the only words that kept his rage in check, that prevented him from striding through the Emerald's garish gold and green doors, demanding a private audience with Rollins and slitting his throat. Brick by brick. It was the promise that let him sleep at night, that drove him every day, that kept Geordi's ghost at bay. Because a quick death was too good for Pekka Rollins. Kaz watched the flow of customers in and out of the Emerald's doors and caught a glimpse of his own steerers, men and women he hired to seduce Pekka's customers south with the prospect of better deals, bigger wins, prettier girls. "Where are you coming from, looking so flush?" one said to the other, talking far more loudly than necessary. "Just got back from the Crow Club. Took 100 Kruger off the house in just 2 hours." "You don't say." "I do. Just came up the stave to get a beer and meet a friend. Why don't you join us, and we'll all go together?" "The Crow Club? Who would have thought it?" "Come on, I'll buy you a drink. I'll buy everyone a drink." And they walked off together laughing, leaving all the patrons around them to wonder if maybe they ought to head just a few bridges down the canal and see if the odds weren't kinder there. Kaz's servant, Greed, luring them south like a piper with flute in hand. He made sure to cycle steerers in and out, changing the faces so Pekka's barkers and bouncers never got wise. And customer by customer, he leached away the Emerald's business. It was one of the infinite, tiny ways he'd found to make himself strong at Pekka's expense. Intercepting his shipments of Geordi, charging him fees for access to Fifth Harbor, undercutting his rents to keep his properties free of tenants, and slowly, slowly tugging at the threads that made up his life. Despite the lies he'd spread and the claims he'd made to Giles tonight, Kaz wasn't a bastard. He wasn't even from Ketterdam. He'd been 9, and Geordi 13, when they'd first arrived in the city. A check from the sale of their father's farm, sewn safely into the inner pocket of Geordi's old coat. Kaz could see himself as he was then, walking the stave with dazzled eyes, hand tucked into Geordi's so he wouldn't be swept away by the crowd. He hated the boys they'd been, two stupid pigeons waiting to be plucked. But those boys were long gone, and only Pekka Rollins was left to punish. One day, Rollins would come to Kaz on his knees, begging for help. If Kaz managed this job for Vanek, that day would come much sooner than he could have ever hoped. "Brick by brick, I will destroy you.
But if Kaz had any hope of getting into the ice court, he needed the right crew, and the next hour's business would bring him a step closer to securing two very vital pieces of the puzzle. He turned onto a walkway bordering one of the smaller canals. The tourists and merchants liked to keep to well-lit thoroughfares, so the foot traffic here was sparser, and he made better time. Soon the lights and music of West Stave came into view. The canal choked with men and women of every class and country seeking diversion. Music floated out of parlors where the doors had been flung open, and men and women lounged on couches in little more than scraps of silk and gaudy baubles. Acrobats dangled from cords over the canal, lithe bodies garbed in nothing but glitter, while street performers played their fiddles, hoping to garner a coin or two from passers-by. Hawkers shouted at the sleek private gondolas of rich merchants in the canal and the larger browboats that brought tourists and sailors inland from the Lid. A lot of tourists never entered the brothels of West Stave. They just came to watch the crowd, which was a sight in itself. Many people chose to visit this part of the barrel in disguise, in veils or masks or capes with nothing but the glint of their eyes visible. They bought their costumes in one of the specialty shops off the main canals, and sometimes disappeared from their companions for a day, or a week, or however long their funds held out. They dressed as Mr. Crimson, or the Lost Bride, or wore the grotesque, goggle-eyed mask of the Madman, all characters from the Comedy Brute. And then there were the Jackals, a group of rowdy men and boys who cavorted through the barrel in the red-lacquered masks of Sully fortune-tellers. Kaz remembered when Inej had first seen the Jackal masks in a shop window. She hadn't been able to contain her contempt. "Real Sully fortune-tellers are rare. They're holy men and women. These masks that are handed around like party favors are sacred symbols." "I've seen Sully tellers ply their trade in caravans and pleasure ships, Inej. They didn't seem so very holy."
"They are pretenders, making themselves clowns for you and your ilk."
"My ilk?" Kaz had laughed. She'd waved her hand in disgust.
"Shavrati," she'd said. "Know-nothings. They're laughing at you behind those masks."
"Not at me, Inej. I never lay down good coin to be told my fortune by anyone, fraud or holy man."
"Fate has plans for us all, Kaz."
"Was it fate that took you from your family and stuck you in a pleasure house in Caterdam? Or was it just very bad luck?"
"I'm not sure yet," she said coldly.
In moments like that, he thought she might hate him. Kaz wove his way through the crowd, a shadow in a riot of color. Each of the major pleasure houses had a specialty, some more obvious than others. He passed the Blue Iris, the Bandy Cat, bearded men glowering from the windows of the Forge, the Obscura, the Willow Switch, the dewy-eyed blondes at the House of Snow, and of course, the Menagerie, also known as the House of Exotics, where Inej had been forced to don fake Sully silks. He spotted Tanta Helene in her peacock feathers and famous diamond choker holding court in the gilded parlor. She ran the menagerie, procured the girls, made sure they behaved. When she saw Kaz, her lips thinned to a sour line, and she lifted her glass. The gesture more threat than toast. He ignored her and pressed on. The House of the White Rose was one of the most luxurious establishments on West Stave. It had its own dock, and its gleaming white stone facade looked less like a pleasure house than a merchant mansion. Its window boxes were always bursting with climbing white roses, and their scent clung dense and sweet over this portion of the canal. The parlor was even stickier with perfume. Huge alabaster vases overflowed with more white roses, and men and women, some masked or veiled, some with faces bare, waited on ivory couches, sipping near colorless wine and nibbling little vanilla cakes soaked in almond liqueur. The boy at the desk was dressed in a creamy velvet suit, a white rose in his buttonhole. He had white hair and colorless eyes. Barring the eyes, he looked like an albino, but Kaz happened to know that he'd been tailored to match the decor of the house by a certain Grisha on the payroll.
"Mr. Brecker," the boy said. "Nina is with a client."
Kaz nodded and slipped down a hallway behind a potted rose tree, resisting the urge to bury his nose in his collar. Uncle Felix, the bawd who ran the white rose, liked to say that his house girls were as sweet as his blossoms. But the joke was on the clients. That particular breed of white rose, the only one hardy enough to survive the wet weather of Caterdam, had no natural scent. All the flowers were perfumed by hand. Kaz trailed his fingers along the panels behind the potted tree and pressed his thumb into a notch in the wall. It slid open, and he climbed a corkscrew staircase that was only used by staff. Nina's room was on the third floor. The door to the bedroom beside it was open and the room unoccupied. So Kaz slipped in, moved aside a still life, and pressed his face to the wall. The peepholes were a feature of all the brothels. They were a way to keep employees safe and honest, and they offered a thrill to anyone who enjoyed watching others take their pleasure. Kaz had seen enough slum dwellers seeking satisfaction in dark corners and alleys that the allure was lost on him. Besides, he knew that anyone looking through this particular peephole and hoping for excitement would be sorely disappointed. A little bald man was seated fully clothed at a round table draped in ivory baize. His hands, neatly folded, beside an untouched silver coffee tray. Nina Zenick stood behind him, swathed in the red silk kefta that advertised her status as a Grisha Heartrender, one palm pressed to his forehead, the other to the back of his neck. She was tall and built like the figurehead of a ship carved by a generous hand. They were silent, as if they'd been frozen there at the table. There wasn't even a bed in the room, just a narrow settee where Nina curled up every night. When Kaz had asked Nina why, she'd simply said, "I don't want anyone getting ideas." "A man doesn't need a bed to get ideas, Nina." Nina fluttered her lashes. "What would you know about it, Kaz? Take those gloves off, and we'll see what ideas come to mind." Kaz had kept his cool eyes on her until she dropped her gaze. He wasn't interested in flirting with Nina Zanuck, and he happened to know she wasn't remotely interested in him. Nina just liked to flirt with everything. He'd once seen her make eyes at a pair of shoes she fancied in a shop window. Nina and the bald man sat, unspeaking, as the minutes ticked by, and when the hour on the clock chimed, he rose and kissed her hand.
"Go," she said in solemn tones. "Be at peace."
The bald man kissed her hand again, tears in his eyes.
"Thank you."
As soon as the client was down the hall, Kaz stepped out of the bedroom and knocked on Nina's door. She opened it cautiously, keeping the chain latched.
"Oh," she said, when she saw Kaz, "you."
She didn't look particularly happy to see him. No surprise. Kaz Brecker at your door was rarely a good thing. She unhooked the chain and let him show himself in as she shucked off the red kafta, revealing a slip of satin so thin it barely counted as cloth.
"Saints, I hate this thing," she said, kicking the kafta away and pulling a threadbare dressing gown from a drawer.
"What's wrong with it?" Kaz asked.
"It isn't made right, and it itches."
The kafta was of Kirch manufacture, not Ravkin. A costume, not a uniform. Kaz knew Nina never wore it on the streets. It was simply too risky for Grisha. Her membership in the dregs meant anyone acting against her would risk retribution from the gang. But payback wouldn't matter much to Nina if she was on a slaver ship bound for who knew where. Nina threw herself into a chair at the table and wriggled her feet out of her jeweled slippers, digging her toes into the plush white carpet.
"Ah," she said contentedly, "so much better."
She shoved one of the cakes from the coffee service into her mouth and mumbled,
"What do you want, Kaz?"
"You have crumbs on your cleavage."
"Don't care,"
she said, taking another bite of cake.
"So hungry."
Kaz shook his head, amused and impressed at how quickly Nina dropped the wise Grisha priestess act. She'd missed her true calling on the stage.
"Was that Van Oxter, the merch?"
Kaz asked.
"Yes. His wife died a month ago, and his business had been a wreck since. Now that he's visiting you, can we expect a turnaround?"
Nina didn't need a bed because she specialized in emotions. She dealt in joy, calm, confidence. Most Grisha Korporalki focused on the body. To kill or to cure. But Nina had needed a job that would keep her in Ketterdam and out of trouble. So instead of risking her life and making major money as a mercenary, she slowed heartbeats, eased breathing, relaxed muscles. She had a lucrative side business as a tailor, seeing to the wrinkles and jowls of the wealthy Kirch, but her chief source of income came from altering moods. People came to her, lonely, grieving, sad, for no reason, and left buoyed, their anxieties eased. The effects didn't last long, but sometimes just the illusion of happiness was enough to make her clients feel like they could face another day. Nina claimed it had something to do with glands, but Kaz didn't care about the specifics as long as she showed up when he needed her and she paid Per Haskell his percentage on time.
"I expect you'll see a change," Nina said.
She finished off the last cake, licking her fingers with a relish, then set the tray outside the door and rang for a maid.
"Van Oxter started coming at the end of last week and has been here every day since."
"Excellent." Kaz made a mental note to buy up some of the low stock in Van Oxter's company. Even if the man's mood shift was the result of Nina's handiwork, business would pick up. He hesitated, then said,
"You make him feel better, ease his woe and all that, but could you compel him to do something?
Maybe make him forget his wife?
Alter the pathways in his mind? Don't be absurd."
"The brain is just another organ," Kaz said, quoting Van Eck.
"Yes, but it's an incredibly complex one. Controlling or altering another person's thoughts? Well, it's not like lowering a pulse rate or releasing a chemical to improve someone's mood. There are too many variables. No Grisha is capable of it."
"Yet," Kaz amended. "So, you treat the symptom, not the cause." She shrugged.
"He's avoiding the grief, not treating it. If I'm his solution, he'll never really get over her death."
"Will you send him on his way, then? Advise him to find a new wife and stop darkening your door?" She ran a brush through her light brown hair and glanced at him in the mirror.
"Does Per Haskell have plans to forgive my debt?"
"None at all."
"Well, then, Van Oxter must be allowed to grieve in his own way. I have another client scheduled in a half hour, Kaz. What business?"
"Your client will wait. What do you know about Jorda Parem?"
Nina shrugged. There are rumors, but they sound like nonsense to me.
With the exception of the Council of Tides, the few Grisha working in Ketterdam all knew each other and exchanged information readily. Most were on the run from something, eager to avoid drawing the attention of slavers or interest from the Ravkin government.
They aren't just rumors. Squallers flying, tide makers turning to mist.
Fabricators making gold from lead. He reached into his pocket and tossed the lump of yellow to her.
It's real.
Fabricators make textiles. They fuss around with metals and fabrics. They can't turn one thing into another. She held the lump up to the light. You could have gotten this anywhere, she said, just as he had argued to Van Eck a few hours earlier. Without being invited, Kaz sat down on the plush settee and stretched out his bad leg. Juniperem is real, Nina. And if you're still the good little Grisha soldier I think you are, you'll want to hear what it does to people like you. She turned the lump of gold over in her hands, then wrapped her dressing gown more tightly around her and curled up at the end of the settee. Again, Kaz marveled at the transformation. In these rooms, she played the part her clients wanted to see, the powerful Grisha, serene in her knowledge. But sitting there, with her brow furrowed and her feet tucked under her, she looked like what she truly was. A girl of 17, raised in the sheltered luxury of the little palace, far from home and barely getting by every day.
Tell me, she said.
Kaz talked. He held back on the specifics of Van Eck's proposal, but he told her about Bo Yul Bayur, Juniperem, and the addictive properties of the drug, placing particular emphasis on the recent theft of Ravkin military documents.
If this is all true, then Bo Yul Bayur needs to be eliminated.
That is not the job, Nina.
This isn't about money, Kaz.
It was always about money. But Kaz knew a different kind of pressure was required. Nina loved her country and loved her people. She still believed in the future of Ravka and in the Second Army, the Grisha military elite that had nearly disintegrated during the Civil War. Nina's friends back in Ravka believed she was dead, a victim of Fjordan witch hunters, and for now, she wanted it to stay that way. But Kaz knew she hoped to return one day. Nina, we're going to retrieve Bo Yul Bayur, and I need a Korporalnik to do it. I want you on my crew.
Wherever he's hiding out, once you find him, letting him live would be the most outrageous kind of irresponsibility. My answer is no.
He isn't hiding out. The Fjordans have him at the ice court. Nina paused.
Then he's as good as dead.
The Merchant Council doesn't think so. They wouldn't be going to this trouble or offering up this kind of reward if they thought he'd been neutralized. Van Eck was worried. I could see it.
The Merchant you spoke to?
Yes. He claims their intelligence is good. If it's not, well, I'll take the hit. But if Bo Yul Bayur is alive, someone is going to try to break him out of the ice court.
Why shouldn't it be us?
The ice court? Nina repeated, and Kaz knew she'd begun to put the pieces together.
You don't just need a Korporalnik, do you?
No. I need someone who knows the court inside and out. She leapt to her feet and began pacing, hands on hips, dressing gown flapping.
You're a little skiv, you know that? How many times have I come to you begging you to help Matthias?
And now that you want something? Per Haskell isn't running a charity.
Don't put this on the old man, she snapped. If you'd wanted to help me, you know you could have.
And why would I do that? She whirled on him.
Because.
When have I ever done something for nothing, Nina? She opened her mouth, closed it again.
Do you know how many favors I would have had to call in? How many bribes I'd have to pay you to get Matthias Helvar out of prison?
The price was too high.
And now?
She managed, her eyes still blazing anger. Now, Helvar's freedom is worth something.
It...
He held up a hand to cut her off.
Worth something to me.
Nina pressed her fingers to her temples.
Even if you could get to him, Matthias would never agree to help you.
It's just a question of leverage, Nina.
You don't know him.
Don't I? He's a person like any other, driven by greed and pride and pain. You should understand that better than anyone.
Helvar is driven by honor and only honor. You can't bribe or bully that.
That may have been true once, Nina. But it's been a very long year. Helvar is much changed.
You've seen him?
Her green eyes were wide, eager.
There, thought Kaz. The barrel hasn't beaten the hope out of you yet.
I have. Nina took a deep, shuddering breath.
He wants his revenge, Kaz.
That's what he wants. Not what he needs, said Kaz. Leverage is all about knowing the difference.
6. Nina. The sick feeling in Nina's stomach had nothing to do with the rocking of the rowboat. She tried to breathe deeply, to focus on the lights of the Ketterdam harbor disappearing behind them, and the steady splash of the oars in the water. Beside her, Kaz adjusted his mask and cloak, while Muzzin rode with relentless and aggressive speed, driving them closer to Terengel, one of Kirch's tiny outlying islands, closer to Hellgate and Matthias. Fog lay low over the water, damp and curling. It carried the smell of tar and machinery from the shipyards on Imperium, and something else. The sweet stink of burning bodies from the Reaper's barge, where Ketterdam disposed of the dead who couldn't afford to be buried in the cemeteries outside the city. Disgusting, Nina thought, drawing her cloak tighter around her. Why anyone would want to live in a city like this was beyond her. Muzzin hummed happily as he rode. Nina knew him only in passing, a bouncer and an enforcer, like the ill-fated Big Bolliger. She avoided the Slat and the Crow Club as much as possible. Kaz had branded her a snob for it, but she didn't much care what Kaz Brekker had to say about her tastes. She glanced back at Muzzin's huge shoulders. She wondered if Kaz had just brought him along to row, or because he expected trouble tonight. Of course there will be trouble. They were breaking into a prison. It wasn't going to be a party. So why are we dressed for one? She'd met Kaz and Muzzin at Fifth Harbor at midnight, and when she'd boarded the little rowboat, Kaz had handed her a blue silk cape and a matching veil, the trappings of the Lost Bride, one of the costumes pleasure seekers liked to don when they sampled the excesses of the barrel. He'd had on a big orange cape with a madman's mask perched atop his head. Muzzin had worn the same. All they needed was a stage, and they could perform one of those dark, savage little scenes from the comedy Brute that the Kirch seemed to find so hilarious. Now Kaz gave her a nudge.
Lower your veil.
He pulled down his own mask. The long nose and bulging eyes looked doubly monstrous in the fog. She was about to give in and ask why the costumes were necessary when she realized that they weren't alone. Through the shifting mists, she caught sight of other boats moving through the water, carrying the shapes of other madmen, other brides, a Mr. Crimson, a scarab queen. What business did these people have at Hellgate? Kaz had refused to tell her the specifics of his plan, and when she'd insisted, he'd simply said, "Get in the boat." That was Kaz all over. He knew he didn't have to tell her anything because the lure of Matthias's freedom had already overridden every bit of her good sense. She'd been trying to talk Kaz into breaking Matthias out of jail for the better part of a year. Now he could offer Matthias more than freedom. But the price would be far higher than she had expected. Only a few lights were visible as they approached the rocky shoal of Terengel. The rest was darkness and crashing waves. "Couldn't you just bribe the warden?" she muttered to Kaz. I don't need him knowing he has something I want. When the boat's hull scraped sand, two men rushed forward to haul them farther onto land. The other boats she'd seen were making ground in the same